from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the celebrated architect who designed the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., is now working on a project right here in San Francisco. David Adjaye joins us to talk about why he sees architecture as a social act and what it's like to be at the top of his game. Then at 10:30, two photography exhibitions of members of the Klamath tribes. One shows how Native Americans have been sensationalized. The other attempts to make them the center of their own stories using tintype photographs. We talk with the photographer and the exhibit curator about the images on display now at the California Historical Society. That's all next on Forum. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You might have heard about the opening nearly a month ago of the National Museum of African American History and Culture on the Washington Mall. The museum covers generations of the black experience in America from the 15th century slave trade to the present, and it's being hailed as groundbreaking. Visiting the free museum still requires advance ticket reservations. Our guest this half hour is the man who designed the museum, David Adjaye, a British Ghanaian architect who has also been brought on to work on the Bayview Hunters Point Shipyard project here in San Francisco. So welcome to Forum, David Adjaye.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the historic opening of the museum.
We're really thrilled. Thank you.
I think one of the things that really makes it stand out is just how different it is from the other classic white marble structures on the mall. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try to describe it, but please help me. It looks like this three square tiers that are rising up, where the walls of these tiers are leaning outward, almost like bronze flower petals. And I've read that you've said that you want the silhouette of a building to be the beginning of a narrative.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, what is the narrative with that shape?
Sure. Well, I love that you called it three bronze petals. In a way, another way to imagine it is maybe three pyramids interlocking into each other upside down. So that sort of gives you the sort
that
of
is, that's
split.
Much clearer.
No, the building, you know, what we wanted to do was to, you know, to really pay homage to this incredible story that the museum is celebrating and teaching, to make a building which not only is just a container for the story, but is the story when you see it from any of the vantage points, from 15th, from Constitution, from the Mall. And so we felt that the profile was important. And in a way, it made a very wonderful connection to where the African-American community come from in Africa, really the forest region, and this idea of silhouettes being very important culturally from that region to kind of signify important buildings or places that are, you know, have reverence, etc. So there was a way to do something that was of a different language to the classical language of the mall, but also, in a way, it's a different classical story, but one that makes a relationship.
And the walls of the tiers that you were talking about, they are ornamental
ironwork.
Ironwork.
Well, it's aluminium work, really. It's an interpretation of ornamental ironwork from the South.
And made by slaves or former slaves in Charleston?
Well, so the inspiration for... So that if the silhouette is looking at Africa, the detail of the of the ironwork, think of the great American houses or sort of buildings that you see in Charleston, Louisiana, the South, with cast iron sort of metalwork with ornamental sort of flower, sort of frozen in metal. We were inspired by that because a lot, what people don't realize is that during the slave trade and during the beginning of the emancipation, a lot of African Americans were involved in timber work and in metalwork. And there were some great metalwork ironsmiths and craftsmen who built incredible houses. One of the most celebrated in the 19th century was Philip Simmons. And I was completely inspired talking with the curatorial team at the Smithsonian, the director specifically, Lonnie Bunch, to kind of look at that work. And we were looking at wanting to make a metalwork skinned building, but we wanted to look then at this particular heritage and to highlight that that it wasn't just about the agrarian sort of landscape and picking cotton. It was about building the infrastructure of America and looking at the architecture of America, and that African-American slaves contributed to the image of American architecture right from the beginning. So we wanted to look at those patterns. And in a way, what we did was to use 21st century technology, computers, to make a mapping of exactly how the ornament is organized. So it's a kind of matrix, which we've then blown up and then created sort of different densities. So it actually is not just decoration. It's also highly environmentally sustainable. It creates a shading for the glass of the building, stopping the sun and creating, you know, all the things that we need.
So you've thought of everything. And of course, amazingly, the spot where the museum is mm-hmm. was once a slave market.
There was evidence of slave markets there, yes. And it's incredible to think about what Washington is now and what Washington was. And in fact, the site was, you know, that part of the mall was a swamp and then it was a canal. And it's really hard to sort of believe that when you look at this incredible landscape now, but it's a really evolved landscape. And it is an artificial landscape, really.
You're a British Ghanaian. Mm-hmm. And you were raised in Britain, though you were born in Africa. Mm-hmm. How do you then relate to African-American history? Mm-hmm. Did you find that was a part of your process?
Absolutely. I think that what people forget is that the diaspora and the continent are completely relational to each other, in the sense that what I mean by that is that when you think about what was happening in America in the 20th century in terms of civil rights and the kind of movements to kind of get emancipation and kind of get what I call the modernity of the African-American community to integrate into society, to be taken seriously as parts of the contribution of society, that was also happening in Africa. That's the time of independence, the kind of overthrowing of the colonial kind of world. It's also the time when there was a huge dialogue between these two communities to inspire them to talk about techniques of resistance, to talk about these ideas. So my family, who are in politics, were very steeped in this relationship and looking at models in America. So in a way, the story for me, the African-American story, is for me the story of the entire diaspora's kind of sort of emancipation and modernity. We all have a relationship to it. So I don't feel it's something that was separate to me, but something that actually is part of that evolution. So I have great empathy with the story. I mean, it's not directly my story, but I have great, great empathy of it.
We're talking with architect David Adjaye, who was the architect behind the African-American, the National Museum of African-American History and Culture that just opened a month ago in Washington, D.C. And you can see images of it on our website. We have a link to the museum's website, as well as a link to David Adjaye's firm, which is Adjaye Associates. You've been now asked to sort of you can describe more fully what mm-hmm. your role is on the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard project, where right now they're building condominiums and apartments mm-hmm. and parks. And my understanding is that you are involved in the spot that meets the bay in that area of San Francisco?
We've been brought in by Hunters Point to basically create, to be the master planners. And what that involves is that there's been a master plan that's been evolving, but they was some concerns about the direction it was going. So we were brought in to rethink that master plan. And so, you know, it's that very important site where the old shipyards were and where, you know, the artist community is now. And it's really, really thinking about trying to create an identity for this area, trying to create a distinctive master plan that creates a new vibrant part of the city. And it involves creating housing, it involves creating new commercial space, it involves making new leisure spaces, more park extension, and really kind of creating a new public place, which was off limits mostly to the public because of the fact that it was in the Navy, to become a new public part of the city where people can go and have a kind of beautiful vantage point in the southeast part of the city.
And I know you said that you're in the early phases and don't have all mm-hmm. the technical details, but can you give us a sense of how you are envisioning that space?
Yeah.
You mentioned some interesting things like that it's a site where labor was performed to help the nation and you want to mm-hmm. honor that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I mean by that was that, you know, during World War II, et cetera, you know, that the African-American community that sort of surged in the Bay Area came because the Navy offered jobs at a time when it was very difficult for African-Americans to get work in the public sector generally. Racism was really hard. There was very difficult times, and people forget that. And Hunter's Point was one of those kind of focal points where the community really got opportunities. And those opportunities have allowed the sort of those who were able to then get, you know, mortgages and stability to kind of send their kids to school, to kind of allow a kind of a mobility, an upward mobility to happen within the African-American community. So I think that's a very important sort of moment in that history, as well as the kind of military history, as well as the pre-military history. And what I'm trying to do with the work is to really understand that this is a very charged part of the city. It wasn't just the kind of landscape that was just built on, that it had this incredible history. And I want to pull some of those things apart, reveal those, to enjoy those, to allow the public to see that through the master planning. You know, one of the largest dry docks is in this position that built several of the kind of large sort of superstructure, Navy architecture that kind of helped, you know, win World War II, et cetera. So there's a kind of important pride that's also in that site. So I want to, you know, I'm dealing with all these areas, but, you know, I love that. I love it when it's complex and there's lots of stitching to do. So I feel like I'm moving, I'm pulling things apart and I'm stitching things together, but I'm also trying to make a sense of place. I'm trying to make a place that will become another destination in the city and offer another quality to this great city.
We're talking with celebrated architect David Adjaye, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can do so by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Perhaps you've seen the National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C. and would like to ask David Adjaye about it or about how he envisions Bayview Hunters Point Shipyard. You can email us as well at forum@kqed.org, post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook and Twitter. I think I'm getting a better sense now in hearing your description about how you envision the Bayview Hunters Point mm-hmm. Shipyard in terms of what you mean as architecture as a social act.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What's it been like to see – right now you've been described as the architect of our time.
Oh, my God.
A starchitect, in fact, is a word that I've heard in terms of describing you. And other folks have talked about how you've gotten to this point sort of very quickly compared to other folks. Curious what your reaction is to all of this praise. And
well, I've been working for nearly 20 years, so I don't know if that's seen as being very quick. I think that a lot of people have started to notice my work because, of course, the museum is such a high-profile project. But, you know, the museum itself is a work that's taken 8 years of my life, very focused, committed work. It's not something that I've, you know, this position is not something that I've just suddenly stumbled on or, you know, rushing to. I started my career very early because of the difficulty of the profession and wanting to, you know, in that 90s, I sort of wanted to start out on my own. So in a way, I started early. So some people think I'm young. You know, architecture, when you hit 50, you're still seen as a kind of young pup, and I'm 50. You know, I'm considered a sort of younglin, you know, a sort of a cub in the game. But I've been working for 20 years, and I've built a sort of thought that architecture on its own is not enough, that it needs to be driven by a social sort of agenda, social agency, and that we need to unfold that within our time and to be cognizant of place in a really precise way, not in a general way, and really understanding the way in which society and culture evolve from the kind of specificity of place and the unique cultures that we develop in place that sometimes we think are generic but actually are not, have very beautiful nuances and tendencies which need to be celebrated because they're about our time, and I love that.
But as someone who travels so much, mm-hmm. you are somebody I've read that rarely spends two consecutive nights in the same bed. And maybe that's changed now because it's been a couple years since that article made that point. But you do travel very often. You have homes
yes.
in London and in New York.
Yes.
And so where is home for you? Where is place?
Place is where the family is at the moment. But but it's literally, I mean, we, you know, London has been my home. So London is base. But we are working a lot in the US. So we have New York is also a home. But yes, there's a kind of sort of mobility that I have in my work, but it's something that I've sought. I'm very interested in not just one particular place, but I'm also interested in the idea of how the planet, you know, if I can use that word rather than global or anything, because I'm not interested in an economic sense, but really the phenomena of the planet and the opportunity to build on different geographies and in different climates and in different lights. I think it's one of the most inspiring things you can kind of have as an architect. And I think it by actually having different experiences, one is able to kind of learn and galvanize from those experiences things that work and things that don't. And to not just assume information through the internet or web as kind of valid, but to actually kind of experience those things and to bring them to practice in the specific places that you're working.
Is that what inspired your travels through Africa?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that. You were documenting mm-hmm. architecture in all these places. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, making the point that a lot of people mistake Africa for being mostly rural or very rural. So even the cities themselves are not really, quote, cities.
Exactly. No, and I think that there's been a lot of emphasis on Africa as a kind of landscape with wilderness and a few sort of and villages. And people don't really have the image of the city in their mind when they think of the continent. And what I wanted to do was to, one, attack that fact and to really shed light on that. There are, you know, now there are 54 countries on the continent. When I was working, there were 53. I visited 52. The only one I didn't go to was Mogadishu because it still is a bit unstable. Essentially, I wanted to look at the nature of cities. And what was very fascinating was that by visiting all these cities and documenting them by myself, I didn't go with a crew or team, and I was doing this whilst I was building my career. I would sort of, whenever I had a break between projects, I'd run to the continent and hire a taxi driver and drive around. Extraordinary time of my life. And I wanted to just record everything from the public architecture to the places where people just celebrated daily life, to the poor, to the rich, to, you know, the geography that kind of make those places unique. And what I realized was that even though there are 54 countries, there are only six regions. And what's kind of beautiful about the continent is that these six regions have birthed all the extraordinary cultures that we kind of have references to, the incredible masks, the skins, the horns, the things that we know. And I started to realize that these things actually work very much to do with their geographies. And even though they're, you know, some of the artifacts that we know relate back to 200-300 years ago, even the cities and the artifacts that are being made now specifically relate to these cultural tropes, even when people are not conscious or not conscious. And it made me realize how profound the imprint of place is on how society and culture works. And I think that that's what I'm interested in looking at in architecture. And I hope that the book sort of shows you that it's not just 54 countries, but it's these six regions and the way in which they manifest themselves, from the desert to the deep forest to the savannas where, you know, mankind came.
And the book is called Adjei Africa, Architecture. Spencer asks, I'm interested in your guest's views on cultural appropriation, particularly regarding African Americans. What are its costs and where is the line between appropriation and cultural sharing and hybridization that can benefit the arts and culture generally?
Yeah, no, I think appropriation may be too strong. I think that knowledge and the unveiling of knowledge is what I'm more interested in. So it's really about understanding the references and the frames and to also understand how that, for me, in the end, contributes to creating environments which kind of have the biggest opportunity to be the most open to the most to the biggest diversity of our citizenry. So in a way, for me, architecture is built up within codes and structures. And what I'm trying to do is to find ways to break down those structures and to bring them back to a place where they're the most democratic, if I can say that. So in a way, I think that that requires a kind of an investment in learning about other places and other things and other people constantly and updating that and understanding that that dynamic just doesn't go away when somebody moves from one place to another. But there are lessons to be learned in each place which help you to understand how the civic life and the public life of your community can be made better all the time.
And let's hear from our listeners. Again, that number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This is a half-hour segment, so the time to call is now. Peter in Berkeley. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity. I was wondering what stage the Hunters Point project is in, and if there's still time to consider a tie-in for a docking point for a visionary floating theater that's being considered for San Francisco Bay.
Thanks, Peter.
It's still at the early stages, but I think that if you have such an idea, you should approach the developers, and we should see it. Absolutely.
Well, you can see the concept at staralliance.org.
Right. Thank you.
Ring of all nations.
Well, Peter, thanks for that. You were also on the short list of architects who was considered for President Obama's library. Now, I know you didn't get it.
Yeah.
And how disappointing was that?
No, you know, I was just thrilled that, you know, somebody like myself who's not American was even made the list. So I was incredibly honored and thrilled. And, you know, we took it very seriously. And for me, you know, just being able to contribute to the thinking that may be happening now that they're moving forward is such an incredible honor. I was just so happy to be on the list.
There were some interesting articles about interviewing you in the process as they were deciding, and you had some very nice things to say about the president. What do you think of his legacy?
I think that this president has kind of created an extraordinary legacy for the beginning of the 21st century. And I think he's created a model for, you know, a model and a template which is going to be really referred to as we sort of all struggle with who we are and what we want to be as we move into this 21st century. But there's one thing's for certain. We're going to get closer, we're going to get more connected, and we're going to need to learn about each other. And I think we have a president who's really shown a vision about how to live in the future.
Well, Timothy in San Jose, what's on your mind?
Mr. Adjaye, the American people paid for about a dozen Jewish Holocaust museums distributed around the country. I believe the U.S. taxpayers paid for the Martin Luther King Museum also, which is a fine institution. Are they competing with this African-American newly built museum, or are they going to be part of a nationwide African-American remembrance type network of museums all across the country?
Well, that's a great question. This museum is specifically about creating a Smithsonian on the mall, but there are about 200 museums dedicated to African American history and culture, usually in the private sector, but in a lot of communities, much smaller sometimes community infrastructure. But I think what's interesting about seeing the response to this museum, you know, there are easily 10,000 people a day going to the museum right now, that there is definitely a thirst for information about the community and its contribution to the identity of America and to the building of America. So I think that there's room for maybe more structural and more developed museums to kind of appear in maybe key strategic cities.
Well, Tiffany, thanks so much for your call. And speaking of African-American museums, I do just want to play a little bite from President Obama when he was opening the museum, because I feel like it really captured what he hopes it will be for this country.
This is the place to understand how protest and love of country don't merely coexist, but inform each other. How men can proudly win the gold for their country, but still insist on raising a black gloved fist. How we can wear an I Can't Breathe t-shirt and still grieve for fallen police officers. We're not a burden on America or a stain on America. We're an object of pity or charity for America. We're America. And that's what this museum explains.
That's a big mandate.
It's the truth.
What does that mean to you?
I think that it's important that people... I think that as time passes, history and stories get lost. And what I think it's saying is that the narratives of all people are really important. And I think in the 21st century, we have to be more cognizant of this as we become denser, as we move more to cities, and as we kind of rub with each other. We have to learn more about each other.
And I think we have time for one quick last call from Matthew in San Francisco. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. It's refreshing to hear this man care so much about the planet and diversity and African architecture with its three homes. Bringing up all that energy.
Oh, Matthew, thanks. So how do you consider the environment in your architecture?
It's paramount to me. I think that the love of the planet is really the first act of an architect to be responsible in what one's trying to do, in using the resources to make things, and then to be humanistic, to be a humanist, and to really understand that what one is making is about the betterment of other people and citizens.
Well, David Adjaye, it's been such a pleasure. Architect David Adjaye of Adjaye Associates. More Forum next after the break. I'm Mina Kim.